A lot of my colleagues have run off to get their lunch, but we're going to be called back into session at 2:30. Many of them have heard this presentation. As they drift in, I'm sure they'll pick up on it. If not too many show up, we may have to rethink this, but we do have to get out of here at 2:30, and I think we can begin, and hopefully they will be drifting in here. It's been a very busy morning. So welcome to the committee. We have with us today Mr. Michael Osterhelm and Mr. Gene Miriam from the Freshwater Society. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just by way of introduction, I am president of the Freshwater Society, and Dr. Osterhelm was a member of our guardianship council that developed the report that we're here today to talk about, and I think you've got copies of that. And let me just say a couple of things by way of introduction and disclaimer. As I say, I'm president of the Freshwater Society, but I am not a lobbyist, and I want to make it clear that we're here at your invitation.
Yes.
For the record, and it becomes important because of the nature of the Freshwater Society's organization and revenue sources to maintain our tax-exempt status, we're effectively prohibited from doing any lobbying, unlike most 501c3s, of which we are, that can do some degree of lobbying. We cannot effectively do any. So I want to make that clear. The Freshwater Society is a private nonprofit that's been around for over 40 years, and over that time period, its mission has been constant, but its organizational focus has morphed a few times. I started with the Freshwater Society about a year and a half ago, and my board asked me to help the society figure out where we want to focus our efforts and marshal our resources in the near future. We formed what we called our Guardianship Council, and you can see the membership of that a group of people, what I would describe as a blue ribbon panel, and I think many of those names would be familiar to many of you. And people that spent a good share of their time over the course of about 7 months exploring the issues of groundwater and surface water, endeavoring to develop those that we should be most concerned about. And after doing that focusing those efforts, recommended to the Freshwater Society Board that it focus its resources on two critical areas that they described as most important and immediate, and that's groundwater sustainability. And when I talk about groundwater sustainability, and as we talk about it in this report, we talk both in terms of quantity and quality of groundwater, as well as non-point source pollution of surface water. And groundwater sustainability is an interesting one and not gotten quite the attention over the past as, with the discussion of impaired waters, the non-point source surface water pollution. But we thought that came to the conclusion that groundwater sustainability was important, and let me talk a little bit about some of our findings. As you may be aware, that about 90% of Minnesotans get all or a part of their drinking water from groundwater. Mm. And that's significantly different than the rest of the nation. Nationally, about three-quarters of the population gets their drinking water from surface water. So Minnesota is much more dependent upon groundwater. We also determined that the rate of pumping of groundwater has increased about 26% between the years 1991 and 2005. while the population increased 18%. And let me point out that we used the years 1991 and 2005 because in recent past, those are the two that are most comparable in terms of precipitation. As you might imagine, the rate at which groundwater is pumped varies significantly depending upon rainfall. In drier years, particularly for irrigation, we have to pump a lot more. We chose, again, 1991 to compare with 2006 because they were fairly close in the annual precipitation, snowfall, and rain. And over that period of time, as we were looking at it, they say it increased 26% while the population was increasing 18%. And breaking that down by categories, you see here the total increase of 26%. Well, there's some significant swings in a number of areas of groundwater utilization. The first one that where there's been a precipitous drop in utilization of groundwater is for air conditioners. And as I know that people that were around in the late 80s and early 90s, like Mr. Knopf and Mr. Jourofsky will recall that one of the major developments of that period of time was to prohibit once-through cooling for air conditioning or to phase it out. And you see the effect of that. We've saved a significant amount of groundwater with that legislation. As you can see there, the municipal use of groundwater from municipal waterworks has increased 26%, the same number as the total increase. And a lot of reasons for that, again, population increased 18%. So you can think of it roughly as groundwater use increasing half again the rate of the population increase over that 15-year period. As we see greater exurban and suburban development, more lawn sprinkling, we see shrinking size of households, a lot of things going into increased groundwater development. But a significant feature, let me point out two things there, that you see the golf course sprinkling. Now, we experienced for sure, for reasons that are inexplicable to me, just kidding, Jack, that the popularity in golf that over that time period, we've seen some fall off recently, but in that decade and a half of the 90s and the early part of 2000, significant increase in golf course demand, and as a consequence, golf courses, and as a result, golf course irrigation rose dramatically.
Could I interrupt?
Sure.
I promised I wouldn't interrupt until the end so that we could move along, but do you have that chart in?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, it's 14. On page 14 of that report.
Thank you.
Should have pointed that out earlier.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
A pretty significant increase in agricultural irrigation or major crop irrigation between 1991 and 2005. We saw the development, not surprisingly, of a lot more intensive row cropping, and as we started putting more cropland in more places, a lot of those places required more irrigation. So we see that significant increase in irrigation during that time period. So the point is that a lot of reasons going into it, but the fact is our groundwater utilization has been increasing significant. One of the things that's gotten attention of recent years is ethanol production because it's a fairly intensive use of groundwater as the permits have come in for ethanol production facilities. A lot of concerns, particularly in certain areas, of what it's doing to the groundwater. And certainly it's had an impact if we've seen the increase with the development of ethanol and the increased utilization of ethanol over the period from 1996 to 2006, in that decade, we've seen that a sixfold increase. But to put it in perspective, the amount of recent groundwater pumping for ethanol amounts to about 1% of the total groundwater use. Golf courses amount to about 2%. So just it's a significant issue, but it needs some perspective as well. And we know that as our guardianship council was looking at what was happening with groundwater, we're starting to see that in certain areas of the state, it's concern about running short of groundwater. And indeed, in the southwestern part of the state, the far southwest, in particular Laverne and Worthington, municipalities and looking at developing rural water supply systems where they're going exploring the possibilities of pumping water out of the Missouri River Basin in South Dakota and transporting it to serve residential needs in southwestern Minnesota. More recently, in 2007, the Met Council issued a report where they identified 18 Twin Cities suburbs where groundwater supplies could be inadequate to meet the needs of growing populations. And the other thing that we talked about in the report, and I want to make sure that the committee, I'm sure you're aware of this, but to understand is that connection between groundwater and surface water. All too often we try to think of them as a dichotomous relationship, but the fact of the matter is our groundwater and our surface water are inextricably connected, and what we do to groundwater affects surface water. Moving on to some of the findings and looking at how we permit new wells for groundwater, the system is built on one that is basically on a case-by-case basis, pump and test, if it shows no deleterious impacts to surrounding wells, we issue a permit, or to drawdowns in noticeable drawdowns in surface area, we in surface waters issue those permits without regard for the cumulative impacts of adding to those well fields. Quoting there from a DNR fact sheet from 2005, there's no standard procedure for evaluating the potential for cumulative reduction in groundwater levels when we're issuing those permits. One of the things that our guardianship council got into exploring, what is the status of sustainability? How do the recharge rates compare to the withdrawal rates? And found a lot of conflicting information and opinions going back a lot of years. And it was kind of intriguing to find that, as long ago as 1961, the Department of Conservation, the predecessor of today's Department of Natural Resources, observed that the metropolitan area is approaching a situation where the margin of safety between supply and demand is too small, and it was time to be thinking about what we're doing about groundwater sustainability. Two and a half decades later, two decades ago, the Citizens League observed that there is no supply problem, and all the indications are that we've got ample supplies for the future. Quoting from a DNR observation in 1990 that it's not sound management to treat groundwater as an unlimited resource. And a Met Council one a couple years later that it's being depleted in many locations. Another DNR source from 2005 that talks about local impacts having been observed and documented to streams, and you can see they're identified there as other wetland areas, and that the fact that there are several locations with groundwater withdrawals are causing declines in groundwater levels that are continuing over time. And if sustainable water use means not having adverse impacts on into the future, then some of our uses are not sustainable. More recently, EQB DNR report the year before last that by 2030, certain counties in the metropolitan area would be using 99% of their renewable water. And again, a draft, I don't know if this has been finalized yet, but as of last year, a draft report from the Met Council of a concern about water supply in certain regions, of looking into the future, certain regions of the metropolitan area. And the conclusion that our guardianship council came to is there's a startling lack of consensus among experts on whether our groundwater use patterns are sustainable into the future and how we're going to go about getting the information that will provide that data. And one of the conclusions of the Guardianship Council in this report was that we need a scientifically rigorous study of sustainability that will inspire consensus among experts and citizens alike. And in the meanwhile, that we as citizens should all practice water conservation and not wait until we have that crisis. Taking off from that, as that report was issued last fall, the Freshwater Society has been working with the University of Minnesota Water Resources Center and have begun co-sponsoring a series of workshops. The first one was held in this past November, planning the next one at this point in early May, with an idea to develop groundwater to address groundwater sustainability by developing guidance documents that can be used to model and monitor groundwater so that we will identify those knowledge gaps, determine what it is we don't know, what it is we need to know, and how we're going to go about developing the data that we need to address those questions. And we've been doing that. Say this has been sponsored by the Freshwater Society and the University of Minnesota Water Resources Center, but we've been involving a lot of academics and academic individuals, the University of Minnesota was from several disciplines, as well as a number of state and federal agency people, including the Department of Natural Resources, the Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Health, the Metropolitan Council, the Minnesota Geological Survey, the U.S. Geological Survey. And I hope I haven't left anybody out. As well as the Groundwater Association, a professional organization that works in this area, that have all been working together in our planning and coordinating group to put on these workshops. And like I say, that's a continuing endeavor, attempting to develop that modeling and monitoring that will enable us to begin to address in a scientific manner those questions of sustainability. Let me, Dr. Osterholm was one of the, all of our members were active, and Dr. Osterholm was very active in this endeavor over the course of the last year plus with the Guardianship Council. And let me turn to him to do the presentation on the groundwater quality issues. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Osterholm. I'm the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, as well as professor in the Schools of Public Health and School of Medicine. I come at this, you might say, at a bit of an angle. I have been involved with water issues in Minnesota for the better part of my professional career here for 30 years while at the Minnesota Department of Health and at the university. And so I'm not here to talk about a specific infectious disease problem today, which I'm sure you're all quite pleased anyway that I'm not, but rather really to talk about the issues as we study them as related to groundwater. Maybe first of all to take a step back and to add a perspective to this issue. Think about the following fact. Today, with 6.8 billion people on the face of the earth, one out of every nine persons ever lived since the cases on the face of the earth. And like so many other resources that we are quickly stripping, whether they were mining petroleum-based products or any other non-renewable resource, water, too, while it appears to be renewable in the sense that we sure have a lot of it sometimes, more than we care to in certain places, groundwater in of itself is a quite unique commodity that in many cases we actually are officially using the term mining groundwater, meaning it's not being replaced. And in Minnesota, there probably is no better example of the complexities of groundwater than understanding a piece of ground is not a piece of ground is not a piece of ground. If you take a look at the state of Minnesota, for example, we are basically the result of some very important historic geologic processes where, for example, if you look at the area of the Twin Cities and roughly southeast of here, what we call the driftless area, this is an area that actually missed the last glaciers. And so there is the term driftless, meaning all of that material that glaciers pushed in front of it is absent. So you have the very steep valleys, you have the hills and so forth, but also you have the remnants of the ocean that came and went multiple times. That's why the limestone that you see here is in essence basically the remnants of ocean crustacea that basically deposited over thousands to millions of years. You have sandstones, which were basically primordial beaches. Both of those have the great capacity to hold water, sandstone in particular. That's very different than if you're west of here in an area that was glaciated where basically the drift is there, large amounts of sand-based materials that are basically the aquifers for which we use to hold our water. And that's very different, again, than if you're up in the Arrowhead region of northeastern Minnesota where through other geologic processes we have rock that's very solid and dense, and only in cracks and crevices do you really find much water. Therefore, its ability to find water of any kind in the ground may be very hard to do despite the fact of a lot of water in the surface. So the point I just want to make is that we have to even be careful in the state of Minnesota to understand when we talk about groundwater, it's not a monolithic term that is equally represented throughout the state. We're very fortunate in many parts of the state, such as southeastern Minnesota, we have abundant groundwater supplies, but on a regional basis can be greatly depleted if, in fact, there's heavy drawing or pumping in those areas. So when we look at the issue of groundwater buried thousands of years ago, think of one other thing. I talked about this great increase in humans as well as production animals and agriculture, and think about the fact that almost all the chemicals that we use in a modern society today, and there are many, many, many thousands of them, have basically been created, synthesized, produced, distributed, and used in the environment in the last 50 to 75 years. Why I talk about that is because where I come from in my discipline of infectious diseases, microbes actually, through a sand aquifer, will be very quickly filtered out. And unless there is some pinhole entrance that that water can get through without being filtered, in fact, you very quickly take out microbial activity in groundwater, and in most instances, it's really quite safe. Now, that's not true if you're dealing with some limestone cracks or crevices. Water can move great distances in a short period of time. But that's not true for chemicals. Chemicals that are deposited today as part of the recharge of groundwater to replace that which has been removed basically is nothing more than the rinse water for our society. And so the quality that we're replacing many of these aquifers with, where we are getting recharge, in fact, is an inferior water. And today we know far too often around Superfund sites or other industrial contamination areas the incredible costs it takes to take some of these chemicals out of groundwater. Now, one of the other reasons that's quite important is because on surface water, where we have basically this flushing action all the time, which is like basically flushing your toilet to a certain degree. We flush them down, and they just keep going down the watershed to somebody else farther down and farther down. They may get trapped in the muds of the bottom of the water, or they make their way to the Gulf of Mexico, as we now know, with the zones of basically no growth down there from some of the things that have washed off. But in the sense with groundwater, that doesn't happen. It goes down in there, and unlike those open bodies of water where microbial activity may actually degrade some of the chemicals, once it's in groundwater, it's pretty much going to be there as it was put in. So any water that we ultimately take back out, we're not just taking the water out, but we're taking the quality of the water out that we were deposited in there. For millions of years, there was nothing to really contaminate that water. It was being laid down, and we're now mining it. As I pointed out, Minnesota actually is in a position where we're seeing more and more, for example, of major water shortages occurring associated with agriculture. Today, agriculture has been by far the greatest pull to groundwater in the United States. Yogalala Aquifer of Nebraska, Colorado, Texas has been greatly reduced to the point of where there are serious questions as to its long-term viability. Other parts of the world that have become major food-growing areas, in India, China, we are within 10 to 20 years of many of those aquifers being totally reduced to being unavailable. So there really are issues here that come. So when we look at the groundwater buried today, we have to understand in some cases it's being recharged very quickly based on the geology, in some cases more long-term, but regardless, it's modern groundwater. If you look at the sand plains of central Minnesota and some areas near Hastings, they're particularly vulnerable because they're in sand areas where actually the recharge from a river and the groundwater is very direct. So as the water is being pumped out of an aquifer, like in the city of Hastings, actually the Vermilion River is the recharge for that. So what's in the Vermilion River actually is what goes in there. In other areas, it goes percolates through the soil level, and microbial activity will improve the quality of the water as it goes through there. So it's very important. You know, if you look at the issue today, while none of us are here to point fingers or pick the culprits, we have to understand that the changing agricultural practices of the modern society have had dramatic impacts on groundwater. Nitrogen compounds from farm fertilizers and septic systems have been found in elevated concentration in groundwater in central and southeastern Minnesota and parts of the Twin Cities. Today, the pesticides that we use, which in the surface waters will actually break down over time. They are degraded with sunlight and microbial activity. But when that same atrazine, for example, which is a broadleaf pesticide or herbicide, excuse me, for corn, gets into a groundwater, it becomes stable until such time as it's withdrawn. If you look at the issue of other chemicals, volatile organic compounds that have been found in groundwater in the Twin Cities and the St. Cloud area. These are modern human chemicals in a sense. Perfluorocarbon chemicals have been found in lakes and wells in the Twin Cities, treated wastewater systems throughout the state. One of the other areas, once it's out of sight, it's out of mind. If it's floating in the water, we see it, it smells, it doesn't look good, we're concerned. If we put it down a septic system that is not sufficiently capable of handling that, we don't see it again. It's gone. But it's not really gone. It's just underground, recharging the groundwater that we ultimately may be using in the near or long term. In addition to that issue, I would just point out that today one of the things that we are aware of, for example, just something as simple as antibiotics. Today we forget about the fact that we've lived with antibiotics for only a very short period of time of human history, kind of one grain of sand on the beach. The last 60 years, antibiotics have been available. Microbes have been evolving for millions and millions of years. Today we're very concerned about microbes actually developing resistance to these antibiotics because of the fact that they mutate so quickly. Once every 20 minutes, a new generation is produced, and we're beginning to lose a number of our antibiotics today because of genetic resistance. Well, the reason I bring this up to you is because today when you and I take an antibiotic, in many instances, the vast majority of that antibiotic ends up in our urine or our feces. It goes into our various water systems, septic systems, into our sewer systems. And what we're realizing is how much this antibiotic is now in the environment. Antibiotics in groundwater are stable. They'll be there until we pull them back out again. And so one of the things we have to keep reminding ourselves is restoring our groundwaters is more of a challenge than just the amount. It's also what is the quality. If we look at the issue today in terms of our recommendations, we must intensify groundwater monitoring, including trend analysis of low-level contamination. We know so little bit about groundwater. It is at best bits and pieces. And while we have overall big pictures of what I just shared, what aquifers have, what kind of water, literally the kind of pumping that can occur is a huge issue. Let me just raise a point that, again, it's not for the purposes of provoking any kind of debate here, but as Senator Merriam very appropriately pointed out, the concern about ethanol production in groundwater is not a major concern, frankly, in most areas relative to what comes out of the ground. It surely can be in a very localized area. But today, for every gallon of ethanol that's produced with irrigated corn, it takes 14 gallons of groundwater to make that gallon of ethanol. And so in areas where we see more and more agricultural use of irrigation water for growing crops like corn, it does become a concern. Is that the trade-off that we want to look at as we look at the issue of groundwater use and for what we're using it for? In terms of we need to research potential harm of pollutants and their synergistic interactions, you know, every chemical in the environment isn't going to kill us or hurt us. Level is very critical. What kind of chemical it is, how well does it break down, what's its bioreactivity. But the bottom line is we're machine gunning chemicals into the environment every day today. And the cumulative effect is one that we have to be obviously very concerned about. And again, I just remind you, groundwater is the perfect vault of saving those chemicals for a future day. They're not broken down. They stay there, and we have to understand that. Finally, to protect our aquifers and groundwater recharge areas from contamination, it's all about the ground. It's all about the surface. While we're concentrating today on what's under the ground, in the first instance, every bit of it either went there millions to thousands of years ago and we're taking it out at a rate that we can't replace it, or second of all, we're replacing it, but replacing it with a much more inferior water. And what we all fear is that one day our kids' kids are going to be paying exorbitant amounts of money to basically refurbish groundwater that one day we took for free, thought that was basically endless and safe. And today we can't begin starting soon enough to deal with the kinds of contamination that's occurring in the groundwater systems. As I just close by saying, as the great Andy Granatelli, the person who used to sell STP oil treatment, would say, you can pay me now or you will pay me later. And the bottom line is how we deal with the quality of groundwater and its recharge is clearly that. We can pay now or we surely will pay later. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll turn it back over to Senator Merriam.
Moving on to the second the major focuses of the Guardianship Council Freshwater Society report, surface water pollution. And I expect it's something you've gotten a lot more attention with the impaired waters reports of recent years. But as we looked at the water issues, came to the conclusion that's one that demands a lot of attention. And for that reason, have made that another major area of focus. Talking about the surface water pollution that we've only tested 20% of our lakes. And of those, 40% of them are showing up as impaired or polluted. As I say, something that's got a fair amount of attention of late. And the sources of those pollutants, you see the breakdown here, and that chart's also in the booklet there. I don't know how long you can read that from. I've forgotten what page it's on, but 33, I'm told.
Thank you.
That's
different. It's a different chart.
Oh, that's a different chart. 36. Okay. And I don't think there's any great surprise in there from what we've been hearing about with the impaired waters and pretty well known and documented at this point. When we talk about surface water pollution, just breaking that down roughly, 14% from point sources and 86% from non-point. When we talk about the 14% for point sources, we can see that since the passage of the Federal Clean Water Act in 1972, we've made some great strides in cleaning up point source pollution. Recalling that a major impetus for that federal legislation, there were the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland caught fire. Lake Erie was a dead sea. We had lots of bad surface water in Minnesota. And we've had some successes when you look at what's happened with the St. Louis River in Minnesota and the Rainy River. Areas that tremendous cleanup of point sources in both those instances, primarily from two sources. One, the timber products industry out of Cloquet and International Falls, respectively, required a change and significant investments, and we're seeing significant results with the improved water quality, improved fisheries, improved ecological systems. And also improved sewage treatment plants. We've put a lot of money into a better sewage treatment over the course of the last four decades, particularly the first two of the last four. And we're seeing good results as we're dealing with point source. The more difficult thing is dealing in a lot of respects, is dealing with non-point source. That runoff from farms, lawns, streets, and parking lots, and indeed from what settles out of the atmosphere. And maybe part of the problem is that non-point source pollution is something in search of a new name. Impaired waters and non-point source pollution is something that what we call landscape pollution, because again, whether you're talking about surface water or groundwater, what you're doing on the land affects what you're doing to the water. Breaking non-point source pollution down, we talked about some of these things that major contributors are agricultural runoff, what we've done to our water systems with ditching, drainage, and dams, causing greater sedimentation, land use changes like urbanization and urban stormwater runoff. We're finding that things we've been doing for years are not very friendly to our water, and gradually making some changes in how we're looking at our urban runoff as well as our agricultural best management practices. Some breakdowns of that non-point source pollution, 60 to 70% of the sediments and nutrients in our waters, our impaired waters, are coming from agricultural runoff. And throughout the U.S., that number is agricultural runoff is the primary source of pollution in 64% of impaired rivers and 57% of impaired lakes. We've seen a fair amount of publicity recently with the Gulf of Mexico and what's happening in the dead zone there, that and where it's coming from, including Minnesota's contribution to the Mississippi waters. We've seen tremendous growth in impervious surfaces. I don't expect that you can make this out very well on the screen, but the point being is the areas darken, it's a result of greater intensification of urbanization and the concomitant roads and parking lots and driveways and rooftops, all of which lead to greater impervious surfaces, which affects what's going into the water and how fast it's getting there. Aphorism that I encountered recently, and I borrow, I think it sends the message that when you're talking about, whether you're talking about the Minnesota River or any other surface water, that you got to remember that every street is a tributary. Mike talked a little bit about those emerging contaminants and other. Do you want to make some other comments as it affects surface water about what we're seeing with endocrine disruptors and other emerging contaminants?
Thank you, Senator Merriam, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As I alluded to earlier, today we're living in a world of chemicals, which fortunately in many cases are extremely beneficial to humans and our environment and the world we live in. But for them, we wouldn't enjoy the quality of life that we do. But also, in many instances, they can clearly create problems when they're encountered in either the wrong place, at the wrong level, among the wrong people or animals. And today, we know that we are seeing drugs, chemicals in general that are both as a result of our excretion of them as humans, as part of industrial processes, or even in some cases meant for human use, but discharged through the actual industrial process to make them. And so that, in fact, you can see here the endocrine disruptors, which have been of great concern about, are we changing the gender-specific nature of our fish? What, and are they basically a canary in the mine for what is happening for humans and water systems? Today, we can create a very safe water as it relates to a consumption from almost any source. The problem is the cost of the technology becomes absolutely astronomical. And so the question is, what's the trade-off to society of having a relatively safe water supply to begin with, so any treatment requirements are minimized to actually create that safe water, versus taking all comers of water because somebody upstream or while ago, and the aquifer didn't care what they discharged. In terms of other areas, we've seen St. Cloud University found evidence of feminization of male fish at half the sites where these endocrine ruptures were found, and other studies around the area continue to show potential changes. Again, we have to be careful to draw direct parallels to human health, but in fact, as we look more and more at these, the more concerns are there, and I think that today, as we look at these chemicals, these are the bellwether warnings that we have more to go with. You want to cover the recommendations?
Sure. In summing up, in the area of the non-point source pollution and the surface water recommendations of the Guardianship Council and the Freshwater Society, first and foremost is we have to accelerate our testing and cleanup of surface waters. We have to change what we're doing, and a significant piece of that is to embrace best management practices for to address the agricultural runoff. And we ought to target better our resources to financial resources to really put it in where it makes a difference, identifying where the pollution is coming from and what we have to do to either take land out of production or whatever the prescription is for the particular problem. And in tying in with the comments about the endocrine disruptors is explore further that threat to get a better understanding of what's happening and what we need to do about it. And just as additional water considerations beyond those two major areas of focus that the council talked about is to think about a different water pricing structure. You know, what we do is as a society, price water as free. When you pay your city water bill, or you put a well in for a private well, or you're pumping irrigation, you're other than for those that need to get a permit from the Department of Natural Resources, there's a relatively small permitting fee, but we really treat the price of the commodity itself as worthless. We put no price on this precious, scarce commodity, and it's to think about how we change the cultural attitudes regarding the value of water. Recognizing that climate change is affecting water, and we're not sure yet how it's going to affect water entirely. A lot of belief that we will see greater storm episodes. We may not see significantly. We may see significantly different shifts in precipitation, but we could expect to see different storm development as it relates to those precipitation events. And lastly, we think environmental education to get as it relates to water, to get a more informed citizenry. And one of the major thrusts that I neglected to say at the outset, the mission of the Freshwater Society is conservation, protection, and restoration of water resources through education and outreach, and to inform people as to what's happening. And not the least of which is an environmental education. We've had for a number of years a Water is Life arts contest that's now expanded throughout much of the state and senior high schools throughout the state to get students to in their artworks that get displayed over here in the north wing of the Capitol annually, that get them to thinking about connecting water as a resource. And that's been fairly successful, but we know that there's a need to do a lot more on educating people about water protection, restoration, and conservation. And just this final thought, the quote, and with that, Madam Chair and members, that completes our report, and we'd be happy to entertain whatever questions you may have.
Thank you, Senator Merriam and Dr. Osterholm. You've covered a great deal of territory, and I don't know where to begin. So if some of you as members of the committee have questions, I'll let you start. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. And Very, very good presentation. Thank you. And we heard part of this before, but not all of it. It's been great. A couple questions. One is about the non-point source best practices, because I asked some questions about that in committee a few weeks ago about how to evaluate whether, you know, non-point source best practices are really working or not. You know, how to evaluate if they're improving water quality. And I was, the answer I got, from, I can't remember who it was from, was you really can't measure whether it's improving the water quality because it's non-point, but you just have to rely on research-based best practices. But you can't really measure it on site to see if it's working or not. What do you think about that? Do you think there's we can do? Oh, is there a way to really measure if it's meaningfully succeed? I mean, the Minnesota River is a perfect example. We spent years doing CREP and other ways of, you know, putting protection, land protection in place. But is it improving the water quality? Can we test that and measure it?
You know, I'm going to deflect that to Dr. Osterholm because he's got. Personal experience. I had the opportunity to hear him give a presentation over at the forestry, the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Sciences forestry department a couple of weeks ago, and because he's actually got his own project where he, and I think he's got opinions about that.
Thank you, Senator Merriam, Madam Chair, Senator. First of all, it is. Yes, much more difficult than a point source to measure. But, in fact, you can measure it. But it takes an extensive set of measures to do so, meaning that every time you have a series of measures at a given point in any waterway, you can measure further down that waterway and measure it again further down and look at the changes that occur. And it's not quite clear that any degradation of the water that occurs between point A and point B, then you know that you've had activity that's contributed to that. In many cases, water itself and the natural movement of water will begin through microbial degradation and so forth to actually begin to clean it up. And so if you give water a chance to do that, it happens. What Senator Merriam is talking about is I happen to have a project in an area, 100 acres that I own in northeast Iowa, which actually is a half mile south of the Minnesota border in the Driftless area. And it has three trout streams on it, two of them originating actually as cold water streams in Minnesota. And one originated in Iowa. When I bought the land, it was severely degraded by agricultural practices that had basically planted corn right up to the sides or else allowed the trees to return. And you may find this quite to the point of contrary thinking, but in fact, trees in much of the area of Minnesota around waterways is a bad thing. In the native prairie areas, there is nothing that is more helpful to maintaining stream banks and improving the kind of siltation that occurs with erosion off these rich prairie soil banks than actually prairie grasses and the native prairie forbs. Trees actually are a major inhibitor to that, and they didn't exist before the first white men because, in fact, we burnt it. In fact, Senator Merriam saw a quote that I read about burns right here in the Twin Cities that occurred where we, and I showed lithographs of the, if you look at Fort Snelling, in 1840, there were virtually no trees anywhere in the Minnesota River Valley or the Mississippi River because, in fact, it was all burned by the Native Americans. So in that case, we actually did a project where we basically merely pulled back the banks, took the deep soil off that had eroded down from the tops of the hills, planted it with prairie, and in a period of 4 years, we could show dramatic improvements in the water quality just on one property from where it came in to where it left. A cooling of the water instead of warming of the water, massive increases in aquatic insects, massive increase in the cold water fisheries. And so you can do it a piece at a time. Every bit of that contamination was non-point source. It was not a point source contamination. So, but it takes money to do the kind of monitoring that we're talking about. And far too often what people want is a snapshot. Go out and get one sample one time. Streams are dynamic. Whether or not you have a dry period, a wet period, whether you have winter, spring, summer, or fall. And so you need a more comprehensive system for doing that. But the investment that you put into that will pay off because it will give you a direct, all what I almost call a dollar-for-dollar measure of just what you're doing. Is it making a difference?
And, Madam Chair, one more question.
Senator Anderson.
Senator Merriam, you talked about the sustainable water planning process that you were undertaking with the University of Minnesota and others. Just tell us where that's What's the end point of that? When can we expect results? And I've talked to the university about this, and just full disclosure, they said they needed some funding to try to continue that type of work, and I'm wondering what you're, and I shouldn't have probably told you that before
I knew that.
Asked the question. You knew that already. So, you know, given that information.
Senator Merriam?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, it's going to take the end point is to develop the information that will enable us to manage the waters in a way that we can make well appropriation permitting decisions, that we can manage protection of drinking water recharge areas, so that we can achieve some level of assurance that we have sustainability with a long enough lead time. And to do that, the object is to figure out what it is that we need to know to develop that modeling. And it gets complicated by figuring out what's under the ground in the various groundwater layers, because that varies from various portions of the state, and then develop the modeling that'll give us some assurance that the decisions made are being made with a sustainable use of that groundwater in place, and sustainable use being that we afford some protection of the surface water ecology. So, yeah, that's going to take some time and commitment of resources from the university or somebody else.
And Madam Chair, one more
follow-up. Senator Anderson, sure.
On that, and I guess I'll preface my question with a comment. In the LCCMR, we've had the opportunity to spend some time in the Driftless area in the last year, and it was, you know, in southeastern Minnesota, and really look at what happens between the water and the geology that's really unique there. And what it really showed me is that, at least in that part of the state, this artificial distinction between surface water and groundwater really is an artificial distinction, at least in that part of the state, because it sort of changes from, right, you know, moment to moment, depending when you follow the water. First it's an above-ground stream, and then it goes underground, and then it pops back up. And that's not so true in some parts of the state. But what I want to ask you related to that is, when you're talking about the need for a sustainability model, are you focusing just on quantity of water and on groundwater usage more than on surface water? And when you say the sustainability model that you're working towards, would that relate to the – I mean, we have also an artificial distinction really in our laws and our agencies between quality and quantity. And are you considering both of those? And are you considering surface water as well as groundwater?
We're considering, the focus is on groundwater, but certainly as it relates to surface water impacts. And as I was commenting earlier, that it is an artificial distinction, more acute in some areas than others, but recognizing that how you're managing the groundwaters are going to affect the surface water and vice versa. I saw the seminary fin was in the paper again recently, and I know some of you recall some battles that were fought a while back on the Savage Fin and the Eagle Creek and the threat from development there and the interconnection between those. So the answer to your question is yes, it's looking at primarily groundwater and primarily quantity, but bringing into play both the quality, because one of the reasons for doing it is protection of recharge areas, and surface water as well, because they're all dynamic and interrelated.
Senator Deal, you had a question?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I've got a statement and a question. Senator Anderson was asking about whether all this stuff does any good or not, and I've been wondering about the same thing myself. And so I've looked at some of the research, and it appears to me that the research supporting the use of buffer strips along waterways and drainage ditches is clearly beneficial.
Right.
And I'm confident that's a good practice. And it just makes sense to have wetlands restored before water gets into the lakes and so forth. And I have a place on my farm where I have three wetlands in a row. It's taking water out of a drainage ditch, and it stops in three wetlands before it gets to the North Fork of the Crow River. And for me, it would be kind of interesting to know whether there's any water quality improvement as the water leaves each wetland to see what really happens. But one point I was going to make is that tiling, agricultural tiling, often gets blamed for being a bad thing. But my experience is the agricultural tiling, the water coming out of that tile line is usually crystal clear water, whereas water coming off the surface often has got some particles of vegetation or dirt or something that you can visually see. So it seems to me that there are places where agricultural tiling, especially if you don't have standpipes that allow surface water to enter the system, can be useful in improving water quality. And I actually have a place on my farm where the heavy, fine-textured soil is well-tiled, and the water is coming out of the tile line crystal clear, and then it moves down a ditch system, which is going through sandy soil, and it kind of disappears as it doesn't often make it to the river, depending on the time of year and the flow. It sinks through the sand, and the groundwater is being restored by the tile water that's leaving the heavy soil. Now, on the issue of trees and streams, I agree with Dr. Osterholm completely on that, because when you put trees in a waterway or along a stream, it's hard for the grass to grow, and the grass does a much better job of controlling the particles of dirt along the stream than trees. In one of the ditch systems I've got on my farm, we just spent $10,000 last fall to take the trees out of the ditch, because wherever the trees were, it was black dirt. There was no grass growing there. In the sections of the ditch where there was no trees, the grass had returned, and the grass was right down to the bottom of the ditch, providing good stabilization of the soil. Now, how do you keep the trees out of the stream in the ditch? Well, one way you can do it is by spraying, and another way you can do it is by grazing livestock. And you put the livestock in just long enough to harvest the grass, eat up any baby trees that are coming, and then get them out of there. And that practice has been shown in some research projects to show that it actually improves water quality to graze the streams in that fashion. Now I'm going to get into my question. Who talked about atrazine? And my understanding is that the Department of Agriculture has not found a level in their work that's above one part per billion. Whereas the health risk limit for atrazine in drinking water is set at 20 parts per billion. So to me, the issue of atrazine in groundwater, it's nice to talk about it. I agree with you completely. The atrazine is broken down in the top 6 inches of the soil, and as it gets out of that aerobic area into an anaerobic environment, it's very hard for it to break down any further. But I have a little bit of a problem, you know, understanding why it's such a big issue when it's such a low level that's been found all over the state. Unless something's happened in the last year or two, I believe it's never been above a part per billion, and the health risk limit is at 20 parts per billion. So what's the problem?
Dr. Osterholm?
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Dill, first of all, thank you for your expounding on your clean water activities on your property. They truly indeed are very helpful in what you described. One point that I just want to clarify, and I think that you would agree with this, is that when we talk about the lack of trees and waterways, we're talking about specifically within the remnant tallgrass prairie areas because of the unique relationship between those grasses, the lack of trees. But when we're in an area such as boundary water canoe areas, we have a very different soil type, a very different geology. We're in the mountains. We're in many other areas of the country. In fact, trees along the stream are actually very beneficial. So it's part of it is, Senator Merriam's heard me say before, we've got to stop the cookie-cutter approach to stream restoration in this country because, in fact, it's not appropriate and it doesn't work. And far too often I see, and I've had to deal with things like the NRCS from the USDA, where they have a single, this is the way you shall do it for the United States of America to restore something. And they mean well, but in fact, it would sure be helpful if we could relate it more to the sand streams of eastern Wisconsin, the driftless streams of southeastern Minnesota, or the glacial drift areas of western Minnesota. They're all very different. And so I just add that as a caveat. In some cases, trees are okay. In terms of the actual chemicals in the water, actually we have more expert people here than myself. I believe that atrazine for drinking water is 3 parts per billion. Is that right? It's 3 parts per billion, not 20. And unfortunately, in some of the areas, Senator, we're beginning to creep up to those levels. We actually are. And one of the issues comes back to what happens over time. One of the indirect measures, for example, of the recent increase in corn planting, we saw over a period of 2 years, over 25% of the acres that were in CPR come out of the CPR as part of the planting for corn to basically meet the needs on the ethanol issue. During that time, we saw a lot of additional atrazine laid down that hadn't been laid down before. In some cases, we have those farmers, which I think you would probably agree with, that just like any business, just like any professional setting of any kind, do things better than others. And we've seen some instances where, while it's not in the farmer's best interest to overuse atrazine, they did. And we've seen bigger runoff areas. When atrazine is appropriately applied, there's the buffer areas, et cetera. It surely makes a big difference in terms of what gets into the water and so forth. But I think you might want to comment, but we clearly have been seeing in a number of areas increasing levels of atrazine, Roundup, the other chemicals that we're concerned about, whether it's soybeans and Roundup, et cetera. I think you'll hear from Commissioner Lingstein in just a minute, and he can address that issue more fully.
Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, members, on the atrazine issue, I really would like to see the numbers on that because it's hard for me to believe the numbers are really going up when you've got genetically modified corn out there where you can spray Roundup on it, no problem. You can spray Liberty Link on it, no problem.
Yep.
Herbicides that dissolve or are compromised or eaten by soil bacteria and the residual thing isn't nearly as much as it is with atrazine. In my own Centrosota co-op located in west central Minnesota, very large co-op, they quit using atrazine altogether just because of the problems of you can't spray too close to a standpipe and because of those new regulations, they just decided to just abandon atrazine altogether.
Right.
So I really question whether atrazine use is really up. And I think I remember this number right. It used to be 20 parts per billion on the health risk limit.
Right.
Maybe you dropped it to three because you have to make the case it's bad or it's getting worse or something. But
I'll explain it.
I'll leave that to the... One of the areas that Senator Anderson, before you leave, I just wanted to make a point. You raised a very important point about southeastern Minnesota and the driftless area and how in the limestone levels of the driftless area, water moves very quickly. I'm an old caver back years ago when I was a bit smaller, and I've actually been trapped inside of one of those caves where it was a large downpour 8 miles away. We were not prepared to have it happen, and within 3 hours, we had a 10-foot wall of water running down inside the cave that we were in. On the other hand, right below that limestone level is a very, very rich sandstone level that has a layer, geologic layer, in an aquitard or an aquiclude that reduces the water. And this goes to your point, Senator Dill. We have seen many inappropriately constructed wells that literally are conduits from the surface to the bottom. And so in an agricultural area where you have surface runoff, where you might have the atrazine and you would not have the normal purification process of going through the soils because you have inappropriately constructed wells or other breaches in that integrity, you can suddenly get contamination down very quickly into those areas. And that has been well documented in many instances throughout the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Dr. Ostrom. I think that's the perfect segue to invite Commissioner Stein to the table. I appreciate
Thank you very much.
I appreciate your presentation, and my guess is we're going to be coming back and revisiting this issue. It's one of particular interest to me, so we will be coming back. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
We have Commissioner Stein with us from the Minnesota Department of Health, and he's going to share with us a summary of the Safe Drinking Water report in Minnesota.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Langstein. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Health Protection at the Minnesota Department of Health, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here today. First of all, as you think about water quality and management of water around the state, sometimes the role of the Minnesota Department of Health plays is obscure or can be confusing to people. We have a mission of public health, which is to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans, and that, and the word all is kind of important in that mission statement, because it's not the there is no such thing as the average person, I've come to learn in my experience in public health. There are people all across the spectrum with health conditions, with certain population characteristics, whether they're minority and ethnic populations, elderly, children, developing fetuses, that there are different characteristics to each of those populations that make managing their health a challenge based on each of our particular roles. So you might not always understand what environmental health is associated with in the Minnesota Department of Health. It's really the job of the Environmental Health Division to protect people's health from contaminants or hazards that might exist in the environment. And that's either do exist or might exist in the environment. So a lot of the work is to manage air, water, and soil, or assist other agencies that manage air, water, and soil to reduce risks and hazards that could affect adversely human health. The Minnesota Department of Health is the state's Safe Drinking Water Act administrator. Just like the Pollution Control Agency is the Clean Water Act administrator in the state of Minnesota, the federal law that applies to safe drinking water is given primacy to the Minnesota Department of Health. And when we talk about water supply and drinking water, we're talking about the water that's coming out of the faucet. We're interested in what people are actually drinking. We look at what's in the ground, we look at what's in streams and lakes and rivers, but our primary interest in our program is what people are actually drinking. And just to give you some statistics on that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, about 1.3 million Minnesotans drink water from surface water sources, community surface water sources. That's 1.3 million people. That's largely the Twin Cities, Duluth, Iron Range cities, communities along the Red River of the North. About 2.7 million Minnesotans drink community well water, groundwater, that's coming out of community wells. And then another 1.2 million Minnesotans drink water from private wells. So the vast majority of Minnesotans drink water from groundwater sources, but the surface water component of drinking water supplies in our state is significant as well. The Minnesota Department of Health collects and analyzes 150,000 samples of drinking water every year. That is done to guard public health. And so we're looking for acute contaminants, acute risks, things that could make people sick or die quickly, bacteria, nitrates for young children are examples. And then we're also looking at more chronic, long-term contaminants that might affect health over a longer term, organic compounds and so forth. We're very proud of the program that we operate and the partnership we have with communities and non-community water systems around the state. 98% of all our population drinks water that fully complies with all the Safe Drinking Water Act requirements. What that says is that people are vigilant. They're treating the water before it's being consumed, and the testing is helping us know that people are drinking safe water. The report that's referenced on the agenda is a report we're required to do annually by the Safe Drinking Water Act. The EPA is the keeper of that law, and they require us to annually summarize the drinking water protection activities in Minnesota and also to identify violations of that of the law and of the standards, and report that to the citizens of every community in the state that are provided with community water supplies. And much of that reporting goes on through the local community water suppliers. Most of you get your water bill, there's a notice on there that says there's a consumer confidence report is what it's typically referred to. You can go to the community's water supply operator, you can go to a website, you can look on our website, and you can learn a lot there about what's been found in drinking water in Minnesota. And some of the things that I don't know if you have a copy of that report, Madam Chair. I don't think we brought copies, but I did bring some handouts that I will speak from because I want to highlight two issues that are of importance to the Minnesota Department of Health that are included in Governor Pawlenty's recommendations for the Clean Water Legacy funding. The first one is to improve and strengthen and accelerate our source water protection activities. So you probably have a handout that talks about source water protection and gives you some maps and some information about communities in the state that are in the process or will be in the process of developing source water protection plans. And then the second handout is some information about our Center for Emerging Contaminants, improving and strengthening the work that we do to look for contaminants of concern. As Dr. Osterholm pointed out, we're finding additional contaminants in the water for a couple of reasons. One is laboratory testing methods are improving, and we're able to look for things that we previously were never able to find because of the lack of precision in laboratory testing methods. As those methods improve and are refined, we are able to find things in water at very low concentrations. The other thing that is occurring is, as Dr. Osterholm pointed out, we have about 89,000 chemicals commercially available in this country, around the world, that are used in various productive purposes, but many of those find their way into drinking water systems and are subject of some emerging concern. And so the handouts I provided are in support of the recommendation in the governor's budget, and I want to talk first about our source water protection program. The source water protection program is really looking at identifying the capture zone for a well. It also, source water protection applies to surface water systems as well. It's obviously a different, larger area that supports stream flows, and it's the entire surface watershed of that body of water. If we were looking at the source water protection plan for Minneapolis and St. Paul, it would be the entire watershed of the Mississippi River upstream of the Twin Cities. But what we've highlighted with these handouts is a lot of the work we do with communities on their wells and groundwater systems. And I wanted to just illustrate two communities that have been through this process, the city of Gaylord, and show their well, their drinking water supply management area. And if you could just look at that map, you'll see that there are three dots in sort of the southeastern corner of the community. Those are the wells that are supplying the water supply for the city of Gaylord. The red line around that is the area that contributes water to those wells within 1 year. So that is anything that would enter the groundwater would find its way to those wells within a travel time of 1 year. That's a critical area then to manage very wisely and very carefully to assure that there are no contaminants released into the ground or that could be released into the ground over that area. The blue line then is the entire wellhead protection area. That's the area that's mapped out as contributing water to those wells over a long period of time. And then the green line is a more legal description line that is used by the community to develop some kind of plan or zoning protection measures over the entire area. Then I wanted to move on to a different community and show you the map for Maple Grove, a suburban suburb of the West metropolitan area here. And in the center of that map, you'll see in sections 13 and 14 a number of wells that are the community water supply wells for those for that community. Again, the blue area is the wellhead protection area, the area that contributes water to those wells, and then the green line represents their drinking water supply management area. And the city then adopts practices, principles in their zoning controls and in their planning efforts to reduce or minimize hazards that might contaminate those sources of drinking water. This is a little different picture. You can see if, for those of you that are hydrologists and hydrogeologists, this one is more of a circle, kind of indicating more of a uniform cone of depression. The map for Gaylord is more of a linear feature of an aquifer, meaning its characteristics are probably a valley, some kind of a buried valley of higher porosity material that contributes flow to those wells. And then because people frequently are curious about where communities are in the process of adopting a wellhead protection plan, we've given you a listing of the communities that are have completed their wellhead protection plan. There's 193 of those. And then as you move on, there are communities that are have completed a plan but are in the process of amending it, and then those that are currently working on their wellhead protection plan. So that's just sort of the listing of facilities and communities around the state.
Commissioner Stein, could you give us some examples of the types of items that would be in those plans? What are they doing to protect those?
Madam Chair, the typical things that go on in a wellhead protection plan is an inventory of the potential sources of contamination. Those might be buried tanks. They might be agricultural feedlots. They may be other potential sources of contaminants that help the community then make plans for the future. That's one facet. Those that go further into kind of regulating land use activities, it might actually be an overlay district in their local zoning controls that's related to drinking water protection.
Do they deal with stormwater runoff?
Madam Chair, if the stormwater runoff were deemed to be a risk to groundwater, if there's high recharge rates in that area, that could be very true. Typically, it'll depend on every community's localized geology and where their wells are drawing the water from. If they're near surface wells, as is the case in several southwestern Minnesota communities where you're dealing with a very shallow layer of sand and gravel that's adjacent to a stream, yes, stormwater management would be a relevant topic there. In another community where the aquifer is a buried bedrock aquifer, less likely that there'd be any risk associated with stormwater. So it's all dependent upon the source of the drinking water and the local geology and the hazard that it may pose. I'd like to just talk briefly about our emerging contaminants investigation. Again, this is a proposal that would expand the department's work into health risk evaluation. And Senator Dill, I thought I might take this opportunity to clearly answer your question about atrazine. You are correct. The Minnesota Department of Health in 1993 published a health risk limit for atrazine at 20 parts per billion. The U.S. EPA set a maximum contaminant level for atrazine of 3 parts per billion. In 2007, the legislature passed a law directing us to use the lower of the standards as our health risk limit. So we have promulgated a rule that will adopt 3 parts per billion as the health risk limit for atrazine.
Question.
Senator Deal.
Madam Chair, Mr. Stein, has there been any groundwater that's been tested that showed more than 1 part per billion of atrazine in it?
Commissioner
Madam
Stein?
Chair, Senator Dill, I'm not aware of any findings that exceeded 1 part per billion. There is more conversation going on over the degradates of various pesticides and what we should be thinking about health risk limits associated with the degradates of various pesticides. I'm not aware that we found anything over a part per billion. That'd be a better question for the Department of Agriculture, who actually monitors and has looked periodically for levels of atrazine. There were some studies done, localized studies done across the state, but I'm not familiar with the results of those studies to give you that answer.
Senator Dill.
Okay. Madam Chair, Mr. Stein. Roundup is by far the most commonly used herbicide right now, and something like 95% of all the soybeans planted in Minnesota are Roundup ready. So that almost every acre's got it on it. And on the corn, it's very popular as well. I don't have the number of acres or percent. But has there been any problem with that herbicide showing up in any drinking water?
Commissioner Stein?
Madam Chair, Senator Dill, I'm going to ask my staff, do we know what the active ingredient in Roundup is that we'd be?
Glyphosate.
Pardon me?
Glyphosate.
Glyphosate? Madam Chair, Senator Dill, if I could get back to you on your first question about presence exceeding 1 part per billion, as well as this question regarding Roundup and its active ingredients, I'd be happy to
follow up with you on that.
Okay.
Go ahead,
Madam Chair, members, that's fine. And I just, one of the points I'm trying to make is I think we're clearly moving away from using atrazine, and we're using a product that disappears very rapidly after it's been applied to the field, and so the threat to the environment is much, much diminished thanks to biotechnology.
Thank you, Senator Dill. Commissioner Stein.
Madam Chair, the list we provided of selected studies of emerging contaminants in Minnesota drinking water is not a list that's really for quotation. It's more to give examples of the types of compounds and chemicals that might be of concern. As Dr. Osterholm pointed out, there are a number of pharmacologically active drugs that are used that are showing up in surface waters as a result of discharge through wastewater treatment systems, and as well as personal care products and breakdown materials from those care products. The science that is emerging on this is posing a number of questions of what potential risks might be present as a result of exposure to these compounds, not only in the environment, but to human health. And so the proposed initiative is to expand our work to evaluate the potential health risks associated with these compounds in drinking water. With that, Madam Chair, what I'd like to do is just entertain any questions and respect your time.
Thank you, Commissioner. Are there questions? Senator Torres Rain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if this will be a question directly to you, Commissioner, but more a suggestion for this committee, Madam Chair. I am having a hard time trying to really figure out in terms of our priorities and how do we move forward in adopting recommendations as we hear the presentations from the experts about, you know, what our priorities should be, whether we look at priorities within groundwater, surface water, how do we deal with providing incentives or creating restrictions for, you know, contaminants and all kinds of issues that we need to address in this committee. Part of it is that when we look at the resources that we have, we don't have unlimited resources. We have very limited resources. And what I would like to hear from both Senator Marion and Commissioner is, could you give us an idea of, from your perspective and from all the reports that you have reviewed and the work that you've done throughout the years, where is that we need to put more emphasis based on the work that you've done? How do we establish priorities in those two areas, dealing with groundwater, surface water, restrictions for contaminants? Where do we go? Because I, as a member of this committee, I'm kind of that's where we want to go to develop a vision and a plan for ourselves. And I would like to hear from the two of you your perspective in a very concrete and practical way.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, from our perspective, let me just frame that by the language of the constitutional amendment, which identified that 5% of the receipts for the increased revenue would be dedicated to drinking water protection. Now, when we hear drinking water protection, we hear things that are similar to our work in evaluating health risks, as well as protecting sources of drinking water through identifying hazards and risks. So the proposals that have come forward from a variety of sources would be relevant under that 5% limit. But let me also say every molecule of water in the state that is in an aquifer or moves through a surface water system may become drinking water someday. It may be a very long time from now, or it may be a very short time from now. So all the work that is done to improve water quality, whether at the surface of the ground or in groundwater, is going to benefit drinking water protection. So While I don't have a specific priority recommendation for you, I do think that the work that will restore surface water resources and improve groundwater quality are directly connected to our interest in protecting public health and the drinking water supplies for Minnesotans. Certainly, a variety of agencies and groups have got ideas about how to do that. I would ask, in terms of the scrutiny of those proposals, what will they do for the long term to benefit water supply management, drinking water quality in general?
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I think we're going to have a hard time finding somebody who will disagree with that statement. I think part of the struggle for me personally is that when we talk about groundwater, for instance, and we talk about our dependence on groundwater and the volume of groundwater that we use and the lack of monitoring, I think maybe what we need to do is expand the use of surface water and restrict the use of groundwater, perhaps, right? Shall we do that? The cost of that, and what does that mean, to the community? And how do we, in this committee, support the creation of new policies, restrictions, and incentives to move in that direction, if that is the direction that we need to move into? But I am not sure that that's the direction that we need to take. But I think what I am asking from you is a more clear statement from your job, because you deal with this, in terms of what our priorities should be, and from your perspective, why. Of course, we need to protect the water, because ultimately what we're talking about is drinking water. But how do we go about utilizing the very few resources that we have in place to really make a difference? So I think what I'm trying to look for here is how do we use this money that we have now in the most efficient way? And that's where I think we need to rely on your expertise and the work that you do, because we can't cover all of it in here. We can't cover all the science in an hour and a half of a committee meeting. So I don't hear some practical recommendations, and I'm hungry for that. I want some practical advice.
Senator Torres-Ray, I believe that the commissioner has given us two recommendations from the governor. It would be helpful if you would, and maybe you don't have the dollars with you, but what was it that the governor set aside for these two recs? Do you know?
Madam Chair, the two recommendations are roughly $3.5 million a year.
Total.
The first year was slightly, reduced because of the delayed receipt of funds through the sales tax collection. But I also would comment, Senator Torres-Ray, regarding expansion of surface water use. First of all, the Twin Cities major regional water supply systems, the Minneapolis Public Water Utility, as well as the St. Paul Regional Water System, do have capacity to expand. You'll find that in asking communities surrounding those two systems whether there's agreement on expanding surface water use versus relying more heavily on groundwater use, that there are other issues beyond the water supply and the water quality that come into play in terms of control of costs and the future of their local control over those systems. I tend to agree, where there's an existing surface water system that is has capacity and has treatment with a known source, quality of a known source, I would say that that water that passes by that intake that is not used is lost to our population. And I'm a personal fan of expanding the use of surface water resources where that's possible. I can also tell you that sometimes you run greater risks. If you were to convert from a groundwater system to a surface water system, you may increase health risks as a result of treatment that would need to be installed or contaminants that may not be present in the groundwater system. So when you convert from one system to another and you change the flows of surface waters and groundwaters, you can create unintended consequences of health risks. So that's a very quick answer to your point about, you know, my perspective on surface water versus groundwater system use. There's it's not just the volume of water that we consider. We consider the impacts on the quality of the water, on population health as well. But certainly where there's available capacity in existing surface water systems, I think that's a rational thing to explore.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Senator Torres-Rain, for which members of the committee are left, she asks a very good question. I mean, we have a task before us that's enormous. And I think what I've been thinking about is that we're going to break it down into two parts. We will have to create an immediate budget for this year. I think we will be using the interim to do a much deeper exploration about all of the various big ideas that we need to explore so that we can do a much more thoughtful 25-year plan. And so that's why we're bringing the various people to the table now, to just get a sense of the scope of the challenge before us. And then we will be narrowing it down to what we need to do for this immediate budget. And as I said, we will then try to put in place criteria and goals and plans so that we, as Senator Anderson has said a number of times, so that we can report out faithfully every year to the public where we're going and how we are progressing toward that. So I appreciate your asking the question, and I recognize the complexity of the challenge before us. Are there other questions for Commissioner Stein? I'm sure we'll be calling on all the folks who testified today and people who have testified in the past and in the future. And I thank you all for coming today to get us started on this. With that, if there are no further questions, I'll adjourn the meeting.